Live Creative Now, episode 98.
Welcome to Live Creative Now with Melissa Dinwiddie, a weekly podcast to inspire you to create your art and share your work, because that's how you will change the world.
Hello, I am Melissa Dinwiddie, passion pluralite artist, happiness catalyst, creativity instigator, and author of The Creative Sandbox Way, here to address all your questions about living a full-color creative life. Whether you think of yourself as not artistic, not creative, which is a lie, or you think of yourself as an artist of any kind, or anything in between, no matter how you define yourself, feeding your creative hungers makes you feel more alive. It's how you change your life, and it's how you change the world. Way back in August of 2015, I received an email in my inbox that kind of made me perk up my ears. Now, I have to tell you, probably 90% of the requests, the requests from strangers that I receive via email go straight into the trash. Actually, probably 95, 98% of the requests that I receive from strangers via email go straight into the trash. But this email, even though it was a request, and even though it was a little on the long side, it got my attention. And this woman who emailed me, whose name is Denise Logan from Chase What Matters, that's the name of her business, she got an invitation to be on my podcast. Now, that said, it has taken a year and a half for the recording of that conversation to go live, which is really embarrassing. And even more embarrassing, there are actually five more conversations from that same time period back in 2015 that are still waiting to be published. I'm really embarrassed about that. Why has it taken so long? And by the way, I have a correction to share with you. I published another conversation just 2 weeks ago with Alessandra Wall, which I said in that recording that it was from last fall of 2016. No, that conversation was also actually recorded in 2015, for the record, I have to say. Why has it taken so long for me to publish and share those recordings? Well, if you have been following me for any time at all, you can guess why these recordings have been languishing on my hard drive. I'll give you one guess. The answer is perfectionist paralysis. In other words, I got it in my head without realizing that I was doing this. I got it in my head that I needed to not only edit the episodes perfectly, or if not perfectly, like really, really professionally, but I had to also provide full transcripts, or at least really phenomenal show notes, really detailed show notes of the conversations. And all of that is really, really time consuming. And so what happened was, as each week's podcast deadline would approach, and that deadline to get the podcast out at 6 a.m. every Wednesday comes up really fast every week. So instead of digging into the vault of recordings, these beautiful, rich conversations that I had, every week I would just default to putting out a monologue, because I know how to produce a monologue, even on the fly, in a way that won't take me, you know, several days of my time. It just seemed like so much less work. It's so ironic, but it just seemed like so much less work to make something brand new than to take something that I'd already put time into and turn that into a finished product. So sad but true, these wonderful recorded conversations so embarrassing, have languished all this time. And then the more time that passed, the more embarrassed I became that so much time had passed. And so they've languished and languished, and that's the story. So I am confessing it now. Thankfully, the good news is that there is an antidote to perfectionist paralysis. And the antidote is intentional imperfectionism. In other words, allowing myself to be human and forgiving myself for being human. Acknowledging, I've got all these recordings that have been languishing. I'm human. It's okay. I'm probably not the first person on the planet who has done something that I'm embarrassed about. And I can bring that out into the light, acknowledge it, and move on. So intentional imperfectionism in this case means accepting that maybe it's okay to put podcast episodes out without transcripts and comprehensive show notes. And, you know, when I made the decision to publish my book, to like get the book done by the time I turned 50 last fall, I made that decision. I made a statement to all of my subscribers that I was going to have to scale back on the work that was involved in getting my podcast episodes out. And part of what that might look like might be putting out podcast episodes without transcripts and show. Not that I'd been putting out podcast episodes with transcripts, but putting out imperfect podcast episodes and putting less time and energy into podcast episodes so that I could put that time and energy into the book. So I'd already given myself the permission to do that. So that kind of liberated me to put that permission, to give myself the permission to dig these conversations out of the archives and get them out into the world where they belong. Okay, so back to that email that landed in my inbox a year and a half ago. Denise Logan, who sent me that email, this is what she wrote. She wrote, "Hi, Melissa. Hope you are well. I'm responding to your post on the Facebook page," which apparently I wrote a post on my Facebook page, "looking for podcast guests who can talk about how creativity changed their life. I can chat about a couple of different angles on this." And she proceeded to write four different short paragraphs. One, "After 15 years as a lawyer, I bought a floral dress that changed the way I saw myself, and I ultimately ran off in my motorhome and for several years where I did a different job for free once a month just to see what someone else's life was like. Dairy farm, lobster boat, furniture factory. Sure changed the way I saw the world around me outside of my former intellectual prison and opened the way to a much more creative life. Two, I accidentally," in quotes, "founded the Dream Box Project. We make boxes chock full of school supplies, toiletries, and toys for children living in long-term foster care. Each box is decorated by the volunteer who packed it and contains a message of hope for the child. Last year, we packed 11,000 Dream Boxes, and they're changing the lives of the volunteers who make them and the children who receive them. Three, I've been doing a series of talks called I'm Okay with How I Am, Even If How I Am Is Not Okay. Healing from the Loss of Your Dream. Although every one of us will face some kind of loss, illness, betrayal, economic hardship, divorce, death, which signals the loss of a dream we held dear, most of us end up face to face with loss, tragically unprepared, and so are those around us. The art of grieving is the greatest gift I've given myself and the people I love. Four, what happens when your old answer to the question, what do you do now, no longer fits? If you thought you are what you do, and suddenly you don't do it anymore, do you not exist? Finding new and creative ways to answer that question has been my own work and that of my clients. Now, if you ask me, what do you do? I'll answer you, I'm the sparkle fairy. And if that made you laugh, I just did my job. If any of these feel like an interesting fit for your show, I'd be happy to have a chat. Big sparkly hug, Denise. Now that is an example of how to write an email to an influencer, quote unquote, and get them to sit up and take notice. Denise had something to offer that was super helpful and really interesting to me. And she wasn't just trying to get something from me. She wasn't just like, I want to get on your show. How can I get on your show? She had something to give me that I thought would be super interesting for my listeners. She had a way to give me an opportunity for an easy yes. And so I did. I gave her that yes. And our conversation was so juicy and so rich. I'm almost glad that it took me so long to publish it. I'm not. I'm still really embarrassed. But I'm almost glad because I got to listen to it again, like I was hearing it for the first time. And it was so fun to listen to it. And I'm glad that you're going to listen to it too, and I hope you will let me know what you think of it. Get some sparkle from Denise Logan, the Sparkle Fairy. Enjoy. Live creative now. Well, the first thing I want to ask you about is, I know you have a really interesting response to the question, what do you do? So I'm going to ask you that. What do you do?
When I'm out and someone asks me that question, what do you do? I always say, I'm the sparkle fairy. And either, right, because I can see you, your face is so lit up. And I realize people either look engaged like that or they walk away. Or they look really startled. And I think that's the perfect delineator for me about who stays in my life and who doesn't earn a spot in my life.
I am so with you on that. When people ask me what I do, I always say I'm an artist, happiness catalyst, and creativity instigator. Mm-hmm. And if same thing, either they light up and they want to know more, or they just look very blank and I can tell they have no interest in talking to me anymore, which is fine. It's a very clear delineator, as you said.
Right. That's one of the ways. In fact, I was out dancing a couple of weeks ago. I dance a ton. So I do ballroom, and then I was at a country bar, actually. And I'm dancing with this guy, and he says to me, so what do you do? And I thought inside, what relevance does how I earn my money right now have any inkling for this question? And so I gave him my standard answer. Oh, I'm the sparkle fairy. And there was like a stutter step. That happened right there.
Oh my God.
And he asked me again. And so I said, no, I mean, what do you do? And I said, well, the two-step, because that's what we were doing. And then he said, no, like, what do you do? And for heaven's sake, I mean, I could have just continued on with that path for him, like, well, if you lead it right, I might do a cha-cha. And what I recognize is that the narrowness of that question and how we begin to define ourselves only by the way we earn our money is so incredibly limiting.
Absolutely. Oh my God, I could not agree with that more.
And one of the things that I think is really painful is that if you lose your job or you don't want to keep that job anymore, if you are fully identified with your job title or the what you do, then the fear that I've seen and heard from many people is that if I'm not that, who am I? What am I? Mm. And that leads to that if I am not what I do, then if I don't do, am I not?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, it also brings up a question for people like me when I had other work. I mean, I actually haven't been an employee since I was 23 years old, but I remember when I graduated, I graduated from college and I went to my 5-year high school reunion because I took a year off, a gap year after high school. And at the time I was pretty lost. I didn't I didn't know who I was. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And so to earn a little extra cash, I was helping my boyfriend out with his family business and doing a little bookkeeping. So I said, well, I'm helping my boyfriend with bookkeeping. Oh, you're a bookkeeper, was the response. And that was so wrong, because that was not, that didn't in any way touch who I was. So that question, what do you do, and aligning it with how you make your money, is so problematic.
It is. And because there's so much more richness to us. I think you may know that I was a lawyer in my first life. I've had multiple incarnations.
I understand that concept.
And so I practiced law for almost 15 years. And I was at a very large event where it was a group that I had participated in for many years professionally. And they had brought in a facilitator to help us work better together as a team. So it was the board of directors. And we were all in a circle, and the facilitator said, and each of you, I want you to introduce yourself by something that no one else in the group might know about you. And so you cannot use a traditional moniker, lawyer, mother, wife, none of that. And as the conversation moved around the room, person by person, I heard amazing things that I didn't know about the other people who were in the room. There was a man who was restoring a car in his garage with his teenage son in the approach of his son's 16th birthday. Super amazing. What a powerful thing to know about him. And I learned just, I could tell story after story about what I learned. The biggest piece that I learned was that as that conversation was moving around the room, I was getting more and more panicky, because the only thing I had to answer was lawyer. Mm. My life had really, really narrowed. And so I could feel myself sweating. I realized, oh, this really fine silk blouse that I'm wearing with my turquoise pumps and my little gray jacket is soaking through. And I actually bailed from the event. I excused myself to go to the ladies' room, grabbed my purse, got in my car, and drove home in the rain crying.
Wow.
It was a huge turning point for me. Wow. Where I realized the other people in the room had something to answer. And over time, my what do you do had become who I was.
Mm-hmm.
Super frightening.
I know you have a very interesting story. That I don't know the full story, but I know it has to do with buying a floral dress. And I'd love to hear that story, and also where in the chronology that floral dress. When did the floral dress come along after this event?
The floral dress came after this event, where I started looking and thinking, what else is there about me? So one day I was coming home from court. I stopped at Nordstrom's and I was messing around in the women's clothing department. And I saw this beautiful floral silk dress, and I took it into the fitting room and I put it on and I twirled in the fitting room. And it was beautiful. And I came out to look in the three-way mirror that are in all women's dressing room areas. And the sales girl was there. And she said, oh, you look so lovely. You should buy that. And I went back into the fitting room and I took it off and I put it on the hanger and I gave it back to her.
Mm.
And I gave it back to her partly because I realized, where will I wear that? I don't have anywhere else. My life doesn't accommodate that. That doesn't fit with who I am. But what I saw was week after week, I would go back to that same Nordstrom's on my way back to the office from court. I would try on the same stinking dress. I would go into the fitting room. The sales girl would follow me in. I would go through my twirl around in the dress. Over and over, I did this. And it wasn't because I couldn't afford the dress. It was because I didn't see how it fit for me in my life. And one day I did buy the dress. I finally bought it. Oh, it was such a delight. I mean, I loved the dress and the sales girl was so happy. We joked about how I should probably get a discount because it's practically used clothing. How many times
I get it on I know I was going to ask you if it was the same sales girl every time.
Most of the time. And I had worn it, you know, probably the equivalent of, you know, 20 hours by the time I bought the dress. But I went home that night and I put the dress on and, you know, twirled around in the living room in front of my husband, who was my law partner at the time. And he looked up from his newspaper, you know, with his scotch and his cigar. And he looked at me and he said, "Where are you going to wear that?"
Wow.
So stinging, because I realized even though I had begun changing inside, the people around me were not changing. And his response to me was, "Why don't you go put on something sensible?" And he did. And
oh
I went,
my gosh.
I went and put on something sensible. But I never recovered from that, really. What happened for me then was I started taking figure skating lessons and I started gardening, and our marriage ultimately disintegrated. I continued to practice law for a while longer until I realized I just really wasn't happy in that. It was one of those moments where I can look at the catalyst of these, you know, that first event where I left crying in my car, the buying of the dress, the ice skating lessons. Piece by piece, each of those events was like me taking off my mask. And each time I tried to put it back on, it fit a little less well.
Yeah.
Until it was kind of like this broken cast of something that I no longer could tolerate having on. And I ultimately left my law practice. And I went a little, some friends from that period of my life probably refer to it as my nervous breakdown, because to people who don't know what's happening, it looks really confusing and scary. What? You're leaving your law practice? But not only did I leave it, I bought a motorhome and I took off in my motorhome thinking, oh, I might go 6 months, clear my head, see what comes next for me. And it turned into several years.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was an amazing adventure for me. The motorhome was almost 40 feet long. I had a little car that I towed behind it. And I started this adventure of 1 week out of every month, I would go to pancake supper, the local firehouse or the church, whatever little social event I could experience wherever I was. And I would meet people, meet the local people. They always know the more interesting things to be doing than what you'll ever find in a guidebook. And whoever had the most interesting job that night, I would say, "Hey, Melissa, can I just come to work with you for a week? You don't have to pay me. I'll do anything you need to have done. I just want to see what it's like to be you. Are you game?"
Wow.
I wish your listeners could see your face right now, because your face looks like most people's face when I would ask that question, like, "Oh, okay." And the very first time I asked this question, I was running with my dogs in Southern California outside a dairy farm. And I thought, I grew up in a suburb of Detroit. I don't really know anything about cows. So I tied the dogs up and I went up and rang the farmer's bell and gave my spiel, like, "Hey, I'll come every day. You don't have to pay me. Are you game?" And he kind of scratched his chin a little bit. He goes, "Yep, wear boots." And I went every day for a week to the farm. And the first day I was able to feed the newborn calves. Oh, I mean, he knew how to hook me, right? I'm definitely coming back day two. And then I worked the milking machine and I did some bookkeeping. And one of the days I drove a big tractor full of manure, which I thought being a lawyer had fully prepared me for that skill.
Oh my God, yes, the poetic irony of that.
And at the end of the week, I had this amazing insight into what his life was like. And I actually felt bad going to the grocery store and realizing I could buy milk for $1.49 or whatever the price of milk was then. Because all the things that went into that quart of milk that I was buying, not only on the farm, but it made me think, oh, there was a truck driver who came and gathered the milk from the farm and took it to a processing plant. And then it was delivered to the grocery store. And the grocery store clerk stocked the shelves and checked me out. Oh, my gosh, how many hands were touching that product that I was using? And it changed the way I viewed what I had been doing.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. Education.
Yeah, and I think coming from, especially at that point in my life where I was coming from a really intellectual job where I was paid to use my brain, it would have been very easy to get disconnected from the value of what other people do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I recognize that when we ask that question, what do you do? And we peg someone based on their answer to that question. I could have said, I feed newborn calves. I drive a tractor full of manure. I am a bookkeeper. That would have colored the way people saw me.
Absolutely.
And in many instances, when that's the question that we're asking someone else, we don't think about who this person is and how what they do is impacting their life. It's just as you said, oh, you're a bookkeeper. I have no more questions for you after I think, oh, you're a bookkeeper. I now have you in a box.
Exactly.
As opposed to, even if that were your answer, you're a bookkeeper, the question that I might ask you is, tell me about the most fascinating entry you've ever made.
Mm.
There's some depth coming then.
Yeah, a story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also personally, I'm interested in what people, how people earn their income, but if I want to know who a person is, I'm much more interested in, you know, what are you passionate about?
Yeah.
What are you creating?
Right. It's a default question
mm-hmm.
that we've come to. And if you really see it many years later, so, you know, I went on this journey for several years of traveling in my RV, and I never told people what I had done before. So people, of course, you know, I was a single gal in my 30s out in this big RV, backing it into a campsite somewhere where everyone else around me had blue hair, right? And you'd see like the old guy looking from across, where's the man? Where's the man over there? And soon enough, the wife would toddle over and kind of, you know, basically, what's your story? How is it that you're out here? And I decided not to tell people that I'd been a lawyer. Instead, I would ask people what they thought I did.
Oh, I like that.
It was super fun. I got a whole lot of different things, and it allowed me to see myself in a different way, especially here. I was on a journey trying to decide, who was I? What did I want to do? What would be the next part of my life? And I realized if I told that I had been a lawyer, people would see me that way.
Right.
The best part is no one ever guessed that.
What's the craziest thing somebody guessed?
Mm-hmm. I got interestingly, a lot of art and creative related things that people would guess. So there would be gallery owner, sculptor, none of which actually fit for me, but super fun.
Yeah.
And because I was doing all these fun, funky little jobs, like I rode a lobster boat in Nova Scotia. That was so much hard work trying to convince that gnarly old dude on the dock that he should take this 5'2" little petite thing out on his boat. And we had quite a week together. And I now think lobster should cost like $300 a pound. That is some stinking hard work.
Yeah, I believe it. Wow.
I worked in a paint store and a furniture factory, and over and over and over, month by month, I was doing my own version of jobs that I'm pretty grateful I don't have to do. They were helping me, right? I'm super glad that's not how I have to make my life. But it was a great way for me to see what other people do and to start touching into, oh, what is that that I do? And the Sparkle Fairy is kind of a funky little piece, because what I often do is help reflect back to people that sparkly thing that's really in them, but they think it's in me.
Oh, wow. Tell me more about that.
It's about giving permission. So if I was able to do that, and it's, you know, just like my Sparkle Fairy story, which is kind of fun. When I talk about having gone off in the motorhome, people either say, oh my gosh, tell me more, or why did you do that? Again, really? Or that sounds horrible. A good discerning tool for me of, oh, who am I going to connect with? How will that feel? And so the fact that I was able to give myself permission to do that, and by the way, it wasn't easy to give myself permission to leave the business that I had built up and spent more than a decade building. And I left behind employees and clients. But I knew that had I continued staying in that job, I was just going to drain out every bit of my life force.
Oh, yeah, that is what it is. That you said it so well. I really understand that. Wow.
So it was an opportunity to do something else. And as I said, the Sparkle Fair is kind of my third incarnation, because there was a period of time where I was the director of a large executive recruiting firm. And I worked with investment bankers and finance guys and helped them move from one job to another. And I realized, wait, they're not getting any happier. They're just moving from one job to another job, making a little bit more money, and then seeming unhappy. So I really started digging into, oh, why aren't you happier? And what would make you happy? And that was about giving people permission to look at it a different way. And what I, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, so you're helping people move from one job to another, and then you actually started asking them that question?
I started asking them that question, which really wasn't so aligned with, you know, being a recruiting firm, right? The goal to get you to go to another job. But it was important for me that not only for the companies that I was recruiting for, but for the candidates as well, that don't make a move just because you think $12,000 is going to make you happier or $40,000 more is going to make you happier. What's really under there? And what I saw was that there were a lot of other things going on in the happy, unhappy continuum for people.
That's
and
for sure.
In many instances, they didn't need to leave their job. I'm not a huge advocate of just hurry up and quit your job and go run off in a motorhome. And make it really crowded in case I want to do that again. But I think it might be something as simple as, what if the fulfillment that you got from your life was flowing into your job instead of thinking your job is the only thing that's feeding that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is so in alignment with my own philosophy around, I guess you would call it life balance, I suppose, or work-life balance or whatever. You know, so many people think they want to make their living from their creative thing. And for the people who do, oh my gosh, I am so with that. You know, that's great. More power to you. But you don't have to make your living from your creative thing in order to live a really big, bold, full color creative life. And that is something that I think we give so little attention to in this culture. I know for me and for so many of the people that I've worked with, once you start doing something that feeds and nourishes you, that's what brings the color to life.
That is exactly it. And can I give you an example?
Please.
Of that? So I was working after I left the recruiting firm and started doing my own thing, which I call Chase What Matters.
Okay, so this is after there was the lawyer, motorhome, and then recruiting firm.
Recruiter, and then Chase What Matters, which was kind of, it continued to be evolving throughout those early stages of my life. I was working with a dentist, helping him try to figure out what was up. So he'd been practicing dentistry for about 23 years. And he said, you know, I'm making a pretty good living, but is this it? Is this all there is? And I think most of the people who I see feel really guilty even thinking that. I've reached this pinnacle of my life. I have everything I should want, and I'm still unhappy.
Wow.
And it can feel really humiliating and shaming for people to acknowledge, I'm still not happy and I have all these things. And for many people, those who are around them are saying, well, just get a new car, get a second vacation house, get a boat, get something. And he had tried a bunch of those things and he just wasn't all that happy. And he was trying to decide, would he leave his job? Would he do something else? And as we started looking at it, I connected him with an organization that did dental implant repair for boys who had been enslaved in Africa. And so there's a group of boys who are here in the U.S. who, when they were first captured, their captors yanked their teeth out of their head. It was a way to brutalize these boys and to make them be willing to be enslaved. So they're here in the U.S., and imagine being in your 20s and you're a young man and you have no teeth.
Oh, man.
Right. Good luck getting a girl or a job. Your self-esteem is in the toilet. And this organization does dental implant repair work for these boys. So I said to my client, what do you think? You want to do one implant? See what you think. If you don't like it, it's okay. We'll find something else. So he did one implant. And the moment he saw that boy smile, his whole life has changed.
Wow.
I know I always get really emotional just thinking about it. And when someone asks him now what he does, his answer is, I rebuild young men's self-esteem.
Oh, my God.
He's still practicing dentistry. His vigor is renewed in a way that is just beautiful to watch. Anyone who ever gets in his chair hears about this work that he's doing. He's completely on fire about it. His patients are also looking for ways that they can do something with their life. And he didn't have to leave his work.
Right.
And that piece of what's creative, right, he was able to use a talent that he already has to do something that leaves a mark in the world.
Yeah.
And while I hope his life is long, I'm quite certain at the end of his life, someone will speak about that. And that will be one of the markers of what did he do with his life. Even if he never did another dental implant repair, it was that change that he made for that boy and how it changed his life.
Yeah. Oh, what a fantastic story.
And I see it again and again and again, that those ways that we're able to give back in some way that isn't just about money.
Yes.
That small act is so transformative, not only for the recipient, but for the person who's making it, and finding those small ways. So I spoke to a mom's group recently, and we were talking about ways that they could make a difference. And one of my personal passions is about foster care and kids in foster care. So there were close to 100 moms in the group that I was speaking to. And I said, how many of you in the room would be willing to bake two special birthday cakes over the next year for a child by request? Every hand shot up. Well, I think every hand. I don't know. Maybe there was one dope in the room who didn't want to bake a birthday cake for a kid. And what that shows me is that, so 100 people together in a room who could each do something that they naturally already do. They're baking a birthday cake for their own kids, likely. Could they do one small act twice a year that would make a magical difference in someone else's life? And that's a way to take a small piece of their own creativity, right?
Absolutely.
And those cakes have been so beautiful and amazing. So a child will say, I would like to have a devil's food cake with Elmo on the top. And the next thing you know, there's a mom somewhere who's saying, I can make that. And those cakes are beautiful.
Wow. That is so cool.
And there are a million small ways like that. So that is the way that I express a ton of my creativity, is stepping in and just helping people or organizations say, how can I give back in a way that lights my own life up and that connects me in a different way? And sometimes it means that they choose that to be their new career and they leave. But mostly what happens is it fills them up and starts flowing over. That sparkle, so remember, I'm the sparkle fairy, that little sparkle starts to fill up their life. And then the people around them see it and catch it. And together we can do so much more, one small act at a time.
Absolutely. You know, your stories make me think about a couple of examples, one from my own life and one from the life of a friend, where it's not specifically about, an act of charity. But for me, when I felt this sense of complete what the heck am I doing with my life? I'm not happy. This is not what I want. And I was an artist. I mean, I was making my living from my art as a ketubah artist, making Jewish marriage contracts, but doing very little actual creating. And the creating that I did do was always very art directed. So there was very little freedom in it. And when I finally got back to making art for me, all the years of saying, I wish I could get rid of this business. I wish I could stop doing this. I didn't feel that way anymore because I was finally being nourished by, you know, feeding my creative hungers. So I actually could get back to enjoying this business that I built. And the same thing with a friend of mine who has a 9-to-5 job and, you know, nothing particularly exciting or creative. And she was pretty darn burned out by it. And then she's a musician, she's a singer, and she joined a klezmer band. And they perform maybe a couple times a month or something, and they rehearse, I think, once a week or so. And, you know, it wasn't every day necessarily, but just the fact that she was feeding that creative hunger of hers, all of a sudden, all of her burnout dissolved because she was getting nourished.
That's so beautiful. I think I heard the poet David White speak, and he was talking about how the antidote to burnout is not rest. It is wholeheartedness.
Oh, yes.
And that we can think, I'm so burned out. I need to go to Jamaica and lay on the beach for 2 weeks. And that might be. I'm not downing that. I'm all about that, heading out to the beach. But if you come back and you're not more full with what I call the sparkle, whatever that is, all you're coming back to is another round before you left. But if you can do something that fills that level of nourishment, however it's coming in, and we substitute. You know, a lot of times I hear people who might want to leave the work that they're in, but they've built up a big economic nut, right? I can't leave because I have this and that. And I started looking at what are those things that were in my own life or in the lives of my clients that are the consequence of doing work that they hated or not having some other form of nourishment. So if you're in a job that you think you hate or you have no other source of fulfillment, then yeah, I do need to go on some intense retreat. I need to go to the massage therapist. And by the way, I like to go to the massage therapist anyway, even though I have a full life. But I don't need to go.
Right.
I go because it's another way that I keep myself full. And that's really different. That gives me so much more choice about how much money I need and what I'm spending my money on, instead of making up for the fact that I have no fulfillment in my life.
Yeah, I think that's so epidemic. I mean, it's certainly not for me and my circle of, you know, my immediate friends and family, but so many people, well, that's not entirely true. I mean, my brother and my sister-in-law, they have some pretty intense beyond 9-to-5 jobs. And I don't know how much they do outside of that, except dote on their wonderful son, my wonderful nephew. but so many people, you know, they kind of live for their vacations or live for those weekends. I don't know. It doesn't seem like, well, obviously for me, it didn't seem like the right trade-off. Because that's not how I'm doing it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, what is that you're doing with the weekend? And sometimes those things that we do on the weekend are just, I mean, we all have chores, and that's part just being grown ups. We have chores that we have to do. But what's the way that we're bringing in a little bit of nourishment? And it doesn't, you know, that's why I use, for example, the difference between the dentist who's doing that great piece and the moms who are baking a birthday cake. It is a degree for everyone. What is the amount of nourishment that you can bring in, that you can offer for yourself, or even reframing the way they're doing work. So I worked with a cardiology group that was super fun. You know, these guys had been making a ton of money, and they didn't like it anymore. They were just kind of like, oh, we're sick of dealing with all the insurance forms and Medicare and feeling hosed over all the time. And so when I came in, I said, tell me about your patients. Tell me about their lives. And they didn't really know that much. Basically, it was bodies who came in and hearts they worked on, and off they went. And so we set up a program where they would ask each patient to bring in someone who was close to them. And often they brought in a grandchild or, you know, that was frequently happened. And we got them connected with a local photographer who would take photos of the patient with whoever they were bringing that was most close. And sometimes they bring a whole gaggle, grandkids or whatever. And then we put those pictures up on the wall in the cardiologist's offices and throughout the space. And it humanized again what they were doing. And several of the members of that practice, now when they're asked what they do, they say, we make sure that kids get more time with their grandpas.
Wow. That is so cool. And this is all stuff that you're doing as a Sparkle Fairy with your Chase What Matters business.
Yeah. And that's a way that in so many ways, then the staff became much less frustrated with the work that they were doing. They were just, oh, okay, we have to fill out these insurance forms and we have to deal with that. But look what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're actually doing something. We're making sure the kids and their grandpas have more time together. And imagine being at a cocktail party and you speak to the person across from you and you say, so what do? And that's the answer that they give you. Think about what that opens in terms of the conversation that follows.
Absolutely. Well, it just, your the name of your business, Chase What Matters, is so incredibly appropriate because, you know, if you're not aware of what matters and what you're doing, then hello, burnout.
Right. Because if you think what matters is money, and money matters enough. I mean, my landlord likes to get paid in cash. He doesn't, or by check. He doesn't like for me to pay in meaning. I have a whole bunch of meaning for you. Wouldn't you love that? No, my landlord likes to get a check like everyone else. But what I found is that when I'm able to see what matters, the way I allocate my time, the way I look at what that is I'm doing is vastly different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And like you said, I mean, of course, money absolutely matters, but all the studies on happiness that I've seen show that money does actually determine happiness up to a certain point. Well, it doesn't necessarily determine happiness, but it can increase happiness up to basically a minimal point. And beyond that, adding more money doesn't make any difference.
It's super interesting. I was just reading a book. In fact, let's see, it's called How Will You Measure Your Life by Clayton Christensen. And I was reading a segment in it last night, and he refers to money as a hygiene piece of happiness, that you must have enough basically to keep things clean and to keep your life hygienic. Beyond that, that's not actually a motivator.
Yeah.
For people.
Well, it's never been much of a motivator for me, which is why I'm not like the classic entrepreneurial type looking for that niche and then building up the business and then selling it and finding another niche and building up that business and selling it. That's never had any interest for me. Money for money's sake hasn't ever had any interest for me, but
I think it's interesting because it's never money for money's sake. It, even for someone who thinks that's what it is, it's about the money. It's about what the money means.
Mm-hmm.
The money is tied to their self-esteem. The money is tied to what they can provide. The money is, it's funny because I watch people act as if the money is about the money, but it's actually about what else it's providing. And I like to say money is called currency. And just like the electric current in your house, you have to be able to turn the switch on and awe for it to flow through. You're just hoarding it up, collecting a big gaggle of it. You know, you can't really store all that electricity anyway. You have to let it move through. And what are we using the currency for in our lives?
Yeah.
Coming back to what matters, right? So maybe what matters is the number of vacations that you take. Okay, that's cool. But let's know that that's what you're chasing. You're not really chasing the money. You're chasing the vacation. What does the vacation give you? Quality time with your kids, with your partner, a chance to scuba dive, great things to post on Facebook so your friends will be envious and jealous. I don't know. But when we dig under, what is it that matters? So coming back to the conversation that we were having a few minutes ago about, so you're making art and then you think, oh, I have to make my art be how I earn my money. Maybe, maybe not. What matters? Is it recognition for your art? Is it simply you can't live with it bottled up inside a second more? Is it getting your mom's praise? Good luck with that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's when I have this conversation with people, that's exactly what it comes down to, is what matters to you. Mm-hmm. And once you know that, then you can craft and design your life with that in informing your vision.
And it's about digging under those questions too, because it's really easy to get the first step of it.
Right. The first
matter. Oh, I need to have security. I need to have enough. That word enough is hilarious. There's a really fun book called The Number. And the author of that takes you through an exercise to figure out how much is enough.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. What is your number? And one of the things that that research shows is that the closer we get to our number, the more likely we are to add a zero to it.
Uh-huh. Well, that's like the story of somebody, a newspaper reporter or somebody asking, it was one of the robber barons, like Andrew Carnegie or somebody, Mr. Carnegie, you know, what, how much is going to be enough? You've made, you know, millions and billions of dollars or whatever. How much is going to be enough? And his answer was a little more. Mm-hmm. I have read that no matter what income level somebody has, their enough is always 20% more than what they currently make.
It's curious, because if you're able to deal with what enoughness means in your life, so we could look at it from food, right? When are you full enough? And can you stop when you are full enough? That's a good place to look. Or when do you have enough stuff in your house? Mm. You know, when have I collected enough art supplies? And what does that mean? And I look at the concept of enoughness from two spectrums. So one end being scarcity, mm-hmm. and one end being abundance. And I find oftentimes people say, oh, I want abundance. But abundance is the other end of the scale. Scarcity and abundance. What about enoughness? Where is sufficiency? And I try my hardest for myself to stay in that place.
Yeah.
Where is enough for me?
Yeah. It's such a great question. And as a practicing imperfectionist who has spent my entire life feeling not enough, that question has been huge in my mind for so many years. And practicing imperfectionism, which really means accepting myself as I am and claiming to be enough, like owning enoughness, mm-hmm. which is a practice. I'm not saying it's an easy thing. I'm not saying that it's something that I do well all the time, but the practice of setting that intention has been so life-changing.
I love what you just said about your own, and I certainly have that struggle. I imagine most of the people who listen in will have it too, that I'm not enough. And if that's the place that I'm operating from, I'm constantly going to feel like I need something else outside so that I can fill my hole of not enoughness.
Exactly.
And if I love the way you said that, because if I can bring that back to myself and say, if I am enough, I don't need to chase so much outside. And what I do need to chase are the things, I hate to keep bringing it back, but chase that thing that matters, that helps me know that I'm enough. So if we look at the dentist, for example, do you think he thought he was enough on the day he saw that boy?
Yeah.
I'm sure he did. And do you think the mom who made the birthday cake for a child in foster care, do you think she felt enough? I'm a good enough mom that day?
Yeah.
Probably so. And where are the ways that that can keep coming back so that the things that we're chasing are the things that are going to help fill that really primal wound that I think so many of us carry?
Well, exactly. And this podcast and my entire brand, Living a Creative Life, is around that. I'm specifically aiming at the people for whom that creative hunger and really feeding it is a huge piece in that feeling of enoughness.
Yeah. How amazing.
I have a question for you that's going back a ways into our conversation, but I'm super curious, since we were talking about money and that, of course, it is really important. You were on the road for a number of years, mm-hmm. and you were doing these jobs for free. You had to fund that multi-year trip. You had to pay for gas. You had to pay for food, et cetera. How did you fund that?
I lived on such a small amount of money that I look back, I'm like, oh my gosh, I lived on probably... I was having this conversation with someone recently, probably less than $15,000 a year.
Wow.
And some of that was, as I traveled where I wanted to be. And I would stay in one place until I didn't feel like I wanted to be there any longer. As opposed to, oh, I need to hurry up and get in my RV and drive all over the country and put on, you know, 50 million miles. I did put on a ton of miles over several years, make no mistake. But I found that because I was doing that thing that was so filling for me, I didn't want so much more.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't need to be we live in an RV. There's a personal rule, which is if something comes in,
something
must
goes
go out.
Out.
There's a lot of utility in living that life.
Definitely.
There's only so much room. And I remember at one point saying to a friend, oh, when I move out of the RV and get into an apartment or a house, it will seem so spacious when I'm able to touch. I won't be able to touch both the bathroom and the kitchen walls from it. But it was a real, I didn't spend much money at all because that was the life I was living, and I didn't want for that much.
And the $15,000 that you spent, was that from savings, or were you earning income on the road?
I spoke some when I was on the road, and I wrote a ton. I would say probably about half of it came from earnings while I was on the road, and half of it came from the small amount that I had been able to salvage before I left. Because
mm-hmm.
I didn't have, it wasn't that I had a big nest egg when I left. When I left my business, it was really kind of a, I need to go.
Wow.
I need to go. And what I did with the law firm was that I made sure that all of my employees were taken in by the firm that was taking over my practice, and that they all had a safe work home to go to if they wanted to go, and that my clients would all be cared for. But it wasn't for me about making a big chunk of money. I knew I needed to go.
Yeah.
That if I stayed waiting for, oh, how can I monetize this? I knew that wasn't what was going to happen for me, that I needed to go. And it was scary, super scary. I hired an auction company to come to the house and take everything out of the house and sell it at auction and send me a check rather than put things in storage because I didn't know how long I'd be gone. And I realized, well, I want my couch after it's sitting in storage for 6 months or 10 years, probably not. And I didn't know where I would land. So it was a super radical downsizing. And I kept a couple of boxes in the basement of a girlfriend's house, things that didn't go in the motorhome with me, but that I couldn't let go of. And several years later, when I went to reclaim my boxes, oh, that's kind of a funny story, but I show up and my friend and her husband bring the boxes up from the basement and we have a bottle of red wine and we're all excited at the opening of the magical time capsule of my boxes from when I left my old life. And we open them and I swear, Melissa, it was as if I had fallen and hit my head when I packed those dang boxes. Because the first box I open has a Radio Shack Slimline phone in it and a small wind-up alarm clock. And my face, looking back, I was like, really? Really? These were, and my friends were so incredibly disgusted that they had, like, you know, kept their kids out of my boxes, rescued it from a flood, and, you know, oh no, those are Denise's most important treasures. And, you know, there was a vase that had been given to me by my great aunt when I was married, and a few pictures and stuff, but mostly it was crap.
That is hilarious.
And I, you know, it's kind of hilarious to look back on that. Oh, these are the things I cannot possibly let go of. Oh, because I guess I didn't think Radio Shack would be anywhere where I needed to live when I got settled.
Well, it's so timely for, I don't know when this podcast episode is going to go live, but on October 1st, I'm starting relaunching a program that I ran 3 times last year called The Great Clutter Bust, which is all about clearing out stuff. And boy, what an apropos story. As we all look at, you know, what we're going to hang on to, remember Denise's telephone and her Radio Shack radio.
It's just so dopey, those things that it's like, oh, I can't possibly live without this whatever. And, you know, having the auction company come and do that, it was a little scary because I was just giving up most everything. And it was, you know, the first, they did it over the course of, I don't know, a week or so. And I went to the first night of the auction. And, oh, it was just sickening. I knew there was no way I could be there.
Oh, I could not be there watching, you know, your beloved things be sold for pennies on the dollar.
And I'm watching this guy buy this amazing piece of art that I brought back from Spain that, you know, the framing and matting alone were way more money than I would want to even acknowledge. And, you know, it goes for like $75.
Oh.
I'm about to throw up in the back of the room. But then someone buys the vanity table that I had bought at, like, I don't know, I don't even know what one of the really cheap furniture stores were in Virginia at the time, but that I probably paid $75 for, and it goes for $600. And I realized, whoa, people are insane. This is all going to average out. And I only had to stand in my driveway and have somebody talk me down $25 on my couch. And when the check came, it was great for me because I was like, oh, that's gas money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Instead of me paying storage on a bunch of junk that I would put in, right. And, you know, I say junk now. It didn't feel like junk then. I had attachment to everything, just like we all do.
But you obviously did fine without all of it.
You know what I did is I took photographs, everything. And then recently I was in a box and I came across the photographs from that time. So they were pictures of, oh, what the yard looked like in that house and the pictures of the art that I had on the walls and, you know, the drapes that I had made, things that were really beautiful. And I realized I have just as much satisfaction coming across those pictures years later. And it immediately brings in for me the emotional resonance and the essence of those without me needing to have them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I've been doing lately is taking digital, you know, now it's all digital, so I can take pictures and let the stuff go.
Yeah, what might that be like? Since for me, why I would have held on to them is because I wouldn't want to let go of the memories or the emotional connection,
Exactly.
the feeling state that that thing evokes. And I realize, oh, I don't have to. I don't.
Yeah.
And of course, there's some things that you would never, ever want to let go. But I find a lot of people who keep things, oh, because my children might want them. No, they don't. That's still junk. Think about that. You're like, I don't want that. Dump it.
Yeah. Well, Denise, I know you have so much more to talk about. I'm so interested in, I know you have a series of talks you're doing that I would love to talk with you about, but we're out of time, so I'll have to have you back for for another conversation.
I really loved it. It's just been so fun to just, even for me, to look back on the journey of the places that my own creativity has shown up and letting me be free.
Well, I have just enjoyed talking with you so much, and I really hope that we keep in touch. And I really would love to have you come back again and
thank you.
Talk about the series of talks you're doing. And where can people find you?
The website is Chase What Matters, and that's chase-what-matters.com. There's a dash between them so that you'll pause enough to remember what matters. So chase-what-matters.com.
I love it. Well, I will also include that in the show notes. And thank you again for taking the time to talk with me today.
You're welcome. So nice to see you, Melissa.
You too.
Take good care.
You too. That's it. That's a wrap. Thank you so much for joining me today. If you're getting value out of this podcast, the best way to thank me is to tell your friends and hop on over to iTunes and leave a rating and review. If you need step-by-step instructions on how to do that, just go to livecreativenow.com/iTunes-review. That's livecreativenow.com/iTunes-review. You would not only totally make my day, but you will help other people find the show, which will help them live full-color creative lives and change the world. That is it. Up until next time. Up until next time. Oh, for goodness sake. Until next time. Thanks again for joining me. And go get creating.
Live creative now. Live creative now.
Subscribe at livecreativenow.com.